The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
A very interesting and promising intervention to prevent HIV infection. As you know, we have already important body of evidence showing that male circumcision is protective against HIV infection. And in this session, we'll have five very interesting papers covering wide areas like efficacy, potential impact, cost effectiveness, and risk compensation. So thank you very much for all being here. It's nice to see so many people. That was not the case in the previous conferences, and I'm glad to see you here. So I'm glad to introduce the first paper from Robert Belli, randomized controlled trial of male circumcision to reduce HIV incidence in Kisumu, Kenya, progress to date. Bob?
Thank you, Bertrand. I'm a little out of sorts because I've never seen Bertrand with a tie on before. So. I want to talk to you today about, as this audience probably knows, there's a great number of studies, over 40 observational studies, that have shown that male circumcision has a protective effect against HIV acquisition in men. There's also biological studies which have shown that human foreskin has high densities of HIV target cells. And, of course, the most recent and most exciting evidence comes from a randomized control trial of male circumcision conducted by Bertrand Auvert and his colleagues in South Orange, Africa, showing a 60% protective effect of circumcision against HIV, and in a per-protocol analysis, a 76% protective effect. The normative agencies, a name that someone gave to UNAIDS and WHO in this case, have declared that male circumcision should not be promoted as an HIV prevention strategy until the results of two other trials are known. One of those is taking place in Rakai, Uganda, and the other is in Kisumu. So I'm going to be reporting today, giving you an update on our trial in Kisumu. There are many people involved in this trial. The names you see on the screen are just a very, very tip of an iceberg. Of many people, over 60 people who are involved in the trial. And the trial is supported by NIH and the Canadian Institute for Health Research. We're testing three primary hypotheses. The first is that circumcision will reduce HIV infection by 50% or more in men in Kisumu between the ages of 18 and 24 years. The second primary hypothesis gets to the issue of safety, and we're testing the hypothesis that circumcision will result in less than a 2% rate of significant adverse events. And then the third primary hypothesis gets to the issue of behavioral disinhibition or risk compensation, where we are seeing whether there will be no difference between circumcised men and uncircumcised men in their reported sexual behaviors. So the study population are people who identify themselves primarily as Luo. The Luo are a group of about 2.5 million people who live in western Kenya in Nyanza province. And according to the multi-site study, about 10% of Luo men in Kisumu are circumcised. So they're a traditionally non-circumcising ethnic group. And in Kisumu, there are over 39,000 young men within the age group that we're targeting. And most of them live within proximity of our study clinic. We're recruiting men who are at moderate to high risk. We do that through STI clinics, VCT centers, but most of our recruitment occurs through peer outreach, and the peer outreach workers, most of them are actually participants in the trial. So those who are included may be included in the trial must be uncircumcised. They must be HIV negative, sexually active, defined as having had sex within the last 12 months, between the ages of 18 and 24, resident Kisumu with no plans to move for the next 2 years, and they must have a hemoglobin of greater than 9 grams per 100 milliliters. They're excluded if their foreskin does not cover half or more of the glands, if they're hemophiliacs or have some other reason for being excluded from surgery, and also if they have an absolute indication for circumcision, such as phimosis. This slide shows from initial screening to the randomization. And 6,686 young men came to our clinic. Of those, 8% did not meet the initial inclusion criteria. And so 6,159 were tested for HIV using double or parallel rapid tests, Determine and Unigold. Of those, 8% were HIV negative and then referred to our support group, and another 1% were inconclusive or serodiscordant. So 5,622 men and were HIV negative. Of those, 20% were excluded on other exclusion criteria. Primarily, many had absence of sexual relations within the last 12 months. Also, others had a medical problem, usually an STI, which we treated, and then they didn't return for subsequent visits. And a number were judged to be unreliable, and some had conditions preventing sex. Many of those reported erectile dysfunction. So 4,489 then were eligible to join the study, and of those, 38% did not end up being enrolled, mainly because they preferred one arm or the other. So they either preferred not to be in the circumcision arm or not to be in the control group. That is, they wanted to be circumcised. So they were naturally excluded because to be randomized, they had to be willing to be allocated to either arm and have an equal chance. So 50% ended up randomized into the control arm and 50% in the circumcision arm. There were no differences between the two arms with respect to many of the baseline characteristics. The mean age of the cohort was 20.6 at randomization. 98%, over 98%, identify themselves as LUO. And about two-thirds, or 66%, have some secondary education or above. And only 6% are married or have a live-in partner. 64% are unemployed, another quarter or fourth of them, about 26%, are self-employed, and only 9.4% actually are salaried employees. This shows first three rows here show STIs at baseline, and 27.6% were HSV2 positive at baseline, 2.1% on urine test for gonorrhea, and 4.6% for chlamydia. You'll notice that the circumcision arm actually has slightly more of these STIs than does the control group, so that's something that we'll probably have to control for in analyses. Age at first sex is 15.5, and the number of partners in the last 6 months is a mean of 1.7, a median of just one. And the lifetime number of partners is 6.3. Those who report consistent condom use, 21.8%, and 10.5% report having been drinking during the last time they had sex. This shows HIV prevalence at baseline. You can see that at age 18, just 1% of these young men are infected, but by the time they reach the age of 24, 17% are infected. This represents a high sero incidence. This, of course, is cross-sectional data, but it translates particularly between the ages of 18 and 23, a high incidence, around 3.5% sero incidence. This depicts the study visits from randomization through follow-up, which is for 24 months. And those men who are allocated to surgery generally go through the operation the same day that they're randomized, and then they come back 3 days, 8 days, and 30 days after the surgery. We check the wound. We ask a few questions about their sexual activity and their level of satisfaction. And then at 1 month and at 3 months, both arms, the men in each arm, are tested for HIV. And at 6, 12, 18, and 24 months, all the men then are given another HIV test, administered a behavioral questionnaire to get at risk behaviors, and then we collect urine, blood, and swabs for STI diagnosis and for later immunological studies. If we detect through lab analysis that someone has an STI, we recall them and then treat them for the STI. All the men in the study get free medical care throughout the 24 months of follow-up. Those in the control group then at the end of follow-up are given the option of being circumcised, or they may wait until the results of the trial are known and then make a decision at that point. So we've had very good success in our follow-up. At the one-month visit, just 8% of visits were missed. Three-month visit, about 12% were missed. At the six-month visit, 9% of visits were missed. At 12 months, 12% of the visits were missed. And by the 24-month visit, 15% of men have missed their visits. These visits translate to 91% person years of visits accounted for, of all the possible visits. So our follow-up has been very good. The next two graphs show you some of the risk behaviors by visit. So in the blue bars, that represents baseline. Gray is the six-month visit, red the 12-month visit, and so on. So you can see that always condom use or consistent condom use goes up from baseline, from 22% up to about 35% at the six-month visit, remains fairly stable after that initial six-month visit. And similarly, condom use during last sex also rises from baseline to subsequent visits, remains fairly stable throughout subsequent visits. Similarly, those men who report having paid for sex or given gifts in exchange for sex in the last 6 months also declines after baseline. So it goes from 9% at baseline down to 11% and then all the way down to 8 or 9% in the last visit. And sex in the last 6 months, any sex with any number of partners, also goes down slightly after baseline, although it's fairly stable throughout the follow-up. So these data suggest that, first of all, our counseling is having some effect. It seems that condom use is increasing, sex with possible sex workers is decreasing, and so our behavioral counseling seems to be having an effect. It also suggests, even though we are blinded to outcomes by treatment arm, it suggests that behavioral disinhibition or risk compensation is probably not a large factor. If the circumcision group were engaging in higher risk behaviors, we'd probably see increases in these measures rather than decreases. So the progress up to July 17th has been that we finished recruitment on September 6, 2005. Skipping down here, we've completed 1,334 circumcision procedures out of the 1,391 allocated to that arm. And 69 in the treatment arm were not circumcised within 6 weeks, suggesting then a crossover rate of 5%. And the crossover rate in the other direction is just less than 1%. So 13 men have crossed over from the control arm to the circumcision arm. We've had 27 adverse events that are either definitely, probably, or possibly related to the procedure. All of them have been mild or moderate, and we've had no severe adverse events related to the procedure. Other surgical outcomes are that the level of satisfaction of the clients is very high. 99% report that they're very satisfied. At 30 days, one troubling result is that 10% of the participants report having had sex since they were circumcised. So even though we counsel men vigorously not to have sex in the first 30 days or after surgery or until they're fully healed, nevertheless, 10% of the participants have had sex by the 30-day visit. And then at 90 days, 65% report having resumed sexual intercourse, and 92% of the female partners who are aware of the circumcision status of their partner report that they were very satisfied, and 5% somewhat satisfied with the procedure. So the expected, we expected, in order to have an 80% power to detect a 50% difference, we expected to enroll 2,776 individuals. We've met that goal in September 2005. The incidence rate that we predicted for the control group was 2.5%. The actual incidence over both arms is 1.8%, which suggests that if there is a 50% protective effect, that we're just about on target in terms of incidence. The loss to follow-up, we said, would have to be 15% or less, and we have achieved that, actually, and better. Crossovers, 5% in each arm. Our crossover rate in the circumcision group is 5%. In the control group, it's less than 1%. So the total person years that will be accrued by the end of the trial are 4,719. As of July 15th or 17th, we've achieved about 84% of the total person years that we expect. So just to summarize key events that have occurred so far is we had our first interim analysis presented to the DSMB in June 2005. At that time, we were instructed to continue. We finished enrollment September 2005, and then we had a second interim analysis presented to the DSMB in June of this year, and we were again instructed to continue. The trial is scheduled to be completed September 2007. There could be another interim analysis before that time, but the date of any additional interim analysis has not been announced yet. So at least by, hopefully by September 2007, we will be able to know whether we should be adding male circumcision to our very limited armamentarium of prevention techniques that we have available to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Can I ask the people who stand at the back, there are available seats in the front, so please don't hesitate to use it. But may I ask you one question? My understanding is that your DSMB has added a new interim analysis which was not scheduled in the proposal. Do you know the reason why they have done it?
Well, as you know, I'm blinded. We're all blinded to the results, so I can't tell you why. They have said that they may have us back within the next 6 months, but they haven't set a date. So actually, you know as much as I do.
So we have time for a couple of questions.
Robert, Miss Toronto. Just curious, I wonder what impact, if any, there was on the announcement of the South African trial results, successful trial results in July of 2005 on the participants. Were there a lot of questions? Were the crossovers from the control to circumcise as a result of the South African trial? What was the impact of that announcement, if any?
Uh-huh.
And how did you handle any, you know, particular questions that may have arisen out of the results?
Well, as soon as those results were announced in Rio, actually we then we started informing all the participants in the trial, those coming in for new visits and any coming in for medical visits, anyone who came to the clinic, we told them about the results immediately. It didn't seem to affect their participation at all. All the crossovers by that time had already occurred anyway. I think the prevailing opinion among the participants and also throughout Kisumu, if not throughout Kenya, is that they really want the results of the Kenyan trial before they make any decisions about the efficacy of circumcision for themselves.
Next question.
This mic.
Back here.
Yeah, John Caldwell from Sydney. You mentioned the female partners reported themselves being, very satisfied with the result.
Mm-hmm.
Is that meant to be a sort of a neutral response, or they actually preferred do you have a sense they actually preferred the outcome?
Well, in our questionnaire, we were asking the men, you know, is your partner aware of that you went through the procedure, and if so, what is her opinion? So the men themselves are reporting that their partners are very satisfied. I don't know what else you'd expect them to say, but but we have done other studies that have shown that many women in this region actually would prefer their partners to be circumcised. And the main reason that they give, and this is true in studies, acceptability studies in many parts of East and Southern Africa, is they prefer circumcised men for reasons of hygiene. So they think of circumcised men as being cleaner and carrying fewer infections.
We are running out of time, so just one additional question. Thank you.
Okay. Paul Purcell in Gender Health. I was wondering if you recruited any gay men or MSM for the study, and if so, if you can account for any differences in protective effect based on sexual orientation. And also, similar question related to sexual practices. Can you account for any differences based on anal intercourse versus vaginal?
Yeah, thanks for that. We didn't recruit purposely gay or men who have sex with men. Only 4 of our men report ever having sex with men. So clearly there's not enough power there to detect any differences. I don't remember the figure about anal sex. I think about 3 or 4% report having engaged in insertive anal sex. Only, I think, 2 of the men who have sex with men reported and receptive anal sex. So the numbers aren't large enough, at least the reported behaviors, the numbers aren't large enough to really detect differences.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And it's my pleasure to introduce the next paper presented by Doug Schaefer about efficacy study conducted in Kenya.
Good morning. It's my pleasure this morning to present 2-year follow-up data regarding male circumcision and HIV infection among tea plantation residents in our Carrizo cohort. As outlined, I will briefly describe the United States Military HIV Research Program, Walter Reed Project, Kenya Medical Research Institute collaboration, and the primary HIV and malaria cohort study. I will describe the methods used in the formation and analysis of our male circumcision cohort. I will present most recent 24-month HIV circumcision data, and actually I'll spend time focusing upon baseline characteristics which may act as confounders, and I'll end with 3 general conclusions. The United States Military HIV Research Program mission is the prevention of HIV disease through development of a globally effective vaccine and targeted HIV surveillance, prevention, and treatment. Our KEMRI collaboration is built upon a long-standing relationship in Kenya with the United States Department of Defense Walter Reed Project. Collaborative HIV vaccine research began in 1998 and is conducted among the rural African highlands of the Southern Rift Valley province in Carrizo. The HIV and malaria cohort study is a 3.5-year prospective natural history cohort study following 2,801 adult tea plantation workers and dependents twice a year since June 2003. The primary objectives of this cohort study are to establish HIV prevalence and incidence, to characterize HIV risk behaviors. Secondary objectives include to profile HIV comorbidities, to establish area, population, normal laboratory values, which have been done and currently being used in our phase 1, phase 2 vaccine study and phase 3 therapeutic study, and to ascertain volunteers' willingness to participate in future HIV vaccine studies. Beginning in June 2003, 2,801 adult plantation and dependent volunteers aged 18 to 15 years were recruited over a 6-month period. This formed our baseline cohort. This cohort has been followed every 6 months. Baseline and follow-up questionnaires have been administered. The baseline questionnaires consist of medical history, sociodemographic information, and HIV risk questions. And baseline and follow-up HIV testing occurs following a standardized ELISA Western blot algorithm. From this cohort, we excluded 1,081 females, 195 men who were positive at the baseline evaluation, 146 or 5.2% who were lost to follow-up at 24 months, and 1 volunteer with missing data. This resulted in our male circumcision cohort consisting of 1,378 volunteers contributing to 2,689 person years of follow-up. Analyses today will be based upon routine simple statistics comparing baseline characteristics, incident rate calculations presented as per 100 person years, and hazard and regression analyses. Overall, 19.6% of the men were uncircumcised and 80.4% of the men were circumcised. While there was no significant difference between age in the two groups, approximately 31 and a half years in each group, there were significant differences with regard to tribal representation and education. Of note, the vast majority of uncircumcised men were from the Luo tribe. With regard to education, more circumcised men reported having received a high school education or greater, approximately 51%. There were also marked differences with regard to marital history and near sexual activity. More circumcised men reported having been never married or married once, 23 and 60% respectively, while more uncircumcised men reported having been married twice or greater, 23%. While there are differences within the strata, more uncircumcised men reported 19 or greater years of sexual activity, approximately 33%. While it did not reach statistical significance, there were slightly more uncircumcised men who reported recent sex with a commercial sex worker. Also, and again not reaching statistical significance, there were trends observed in comparison of the two groups with regard to HIV risk factors and sexual frequency. Slightly more uncircumcised men reported a sexually transmitted infection and or penile sores or ulcers within the last 6 months, as well as a greater sexual frequency. Finally, with regard to baseline characteristics and in consideration of HIV sources and risk factors, there was no significant difference between the two groups with regard to blood transfusion, and there was no significant difference with regard to condom use. Of note, approximately 77% in both groups reported never having used a condom in recent sexual activity. Of those men who were circumcised, approximately one quarter had their circumcision performed by a traditional healer. I'm sorry, approximately three quarters had their circumcision performed by a traditional healer, and approximately one quarter had their circumcision performed by a health worker. Approximately half of the men reported having their circumcision between 10 and 14 years. Approximately one-third had their circumcision in an age greater than or equal to 15 years, and approximately one-fifth had their circumcision less than 10 years. After 24 months of follow-up, we observed 30 incident cases of HIV among 2,689 person years of follow-up, corresponding to a 24-month incident rate of 1.12 cases per 100 person years. The 24-month incident rate for circumcised men was 0.79 cases per 100 person years, and the 24-month incident rate for uncircumcised men was 2.48 cases per 100 person years. These incident rates between circumcised versus uncircumcised men corresponded to a highly significant hazard rate ratio of 0.31, with a 95% confidence interval being 0.15 to 0.64. Given our availability of baseline demographic information, we created two multivariate models to explore the relationship between baseline characteristics as potential confounders to circumcision and 24-month incident HIV. In one multivariate model adjusting for demographic characteristics, age, education, and tribe, the hazard rate ratio increased slightly from 0.31 to 0.54. However, the 95% confidence interval crossed 1, suggesting potentially no significant difference between the two groups. In a second multivariate model adjusting for behavioral or HIV risk factors, the hazard rate ratio remained robust with little change from the univariate, 0.31 to 0.32, supporting the protective effect of circumcision. We feel our study and analyses have several strengths. Our study is a prospective cohort with 24 months of follow-up. We have the availability of sociodemographic data to begin to explore some of the confounders. Our study is based in a general rural population. Much of the data in the current literature is derived from urban populations. Volunteers in our study benefit from extensive pre- and post-test HIV counseling and availability of comprehensive HIV care and treatment. Study limitations must be considered, however, in interpretation of the results presented. Our study is based upon self-reported circumcision, that is, unless the volunteer had a primary genitourinary sign or symptom, a genitourinary exam was not performed. We feel, however, there is a reason to believe a high degree of accuracy with self-reported circumcision. Our study is not designed or statistically powered to detect small differences within circumcised versus uncircumcised strata when considering potentially confounding variables. Risk and harms of circumcision have not been addressed in the presentation. While the obvious benefit is the topic of discussion, we have not given time to risk or harms of the procedure. And finally, I think it's important to recognize that hazard ratios presented may be biased, but HIV risk highly correlated with circumcision status. In conclusion, first, our study suggests circumcision offers a degree of protection from HIV infection in adult men living in rural African highlands of the southern Rift Valley of Kenya. Second, additional controlled and randomized studies designed to describe the relationship of confounding variables, both risks and sources of HIV infection, to circumcision status and incident HIV are needed. And I think it's important to note in the opening, we're aware that there are two randomized control trials, one that has just been presented, one that is ongoing in Uganda, which will have some of the most important information. And finally, careful attention must be given to the risk-benefit profile of circumcision as an HIV prevention measure alone, as well as in relationship to other HIV prevention measures, for example, abstinence, faithfulness, condoms, vaccine, and microbicides. As I mentioned, we have not given time to the risk of the procedure. The HIV cohort study in CRECHO is an important epidemiological study with a wealth of unique information relevant to HIV in rural East Africa. I very much appreciate the opportunity to present our data today, and am quite appreciative to many collaborators. Dr. Debbie Birx is the founder of the CRECHO site and a strong advocate of HIV research and comprehensive care and treatment now throughout Africa in her leadership position at CDC GAP. And most important, I am quite fortunate to work with many Kenyan colleagues and friends for the backbone of this research as well as the program. Thank you.
Thanks, Duke, for this very interesting presentation. First question in the front.
Hi, Ken Nelson from Johns Hopkins. You showed different rates of circumcision in the various tribes, and I wondered, are there data on the HIV prevalence, particularly in women in the various tribes, that are available?
Yes, that's actually currently in review at JAIDS, but we have the primary HIV cohort study describes the prevalence, which is different across the tribes. The highest prevalence observed is consistent with the Luo tribe.
Richard?
Hello, Richard Hayes, London School of Hygiene. Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I just wanted to ask about your adjusted analyses. I was quite surprised that you found quite a change in the rate ratio after adjusting for demographic factors, but no change when you adjusted for behavioral factors. But what I didn't see was a model adjusting for both, and it would have been quite interesting to see that.
We have done those models. I think what was important, what I wanted to show, was the what happens when you adjust for demographic factors. I think what I was talking about, the high correlates of infection with circumcision, particularly within certain tribes who have cultural risk, I think that plays a strong factor in the outcome of the increased incidence. And I think that's why it's important to look to the randomized control trials that can more appropriately adjust for those confounding factors. We have several other models actually have looked at combining those two factors, as well as models looking at interactions between who performed the circumcision as well as age, and I would be happy to talk about those more later. I just tried to truncate the data for the presentation.
Can you just tell us what the fully adjusted rate ratio was?
I would want to get the data. It actually increases when you bring in the demographic factors as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question is the front.
Hi, very nice presentation. Scott Kellerman from the New York City Department of Health. I noticed that 3/4 of the participants had been circumcised by traditional healers, and I know that you didn't include an exam as part of the study, but I wonder, can you comment at all at what that might look like? What is a circumcision by a traditional healer? How does that compare to or differ from a circumcision by a trained healthcare provider?
I think we would have to be careful. As I've said, we've actually started to look at some models that look at interactions with a healer. Given the limited number of incident cases we had, I think you have to be cautious starting to look at those variables. I think what's important is that this study is based in a rural population where there's still more people that rely on the traditional healers as opposed to the more professionally trained medical officers in settings like Kisumu and Nairobi and other areas.
I certainly understand that. I wonder, though, is a circumcision by a traditional healer, is it considered to be a complete circumcision in general? Or I've never seen...
Yeah, there's a lot of information, actually a lot of published information about different types of circumcision within Kenya, and there certainly are differences, and I think those are important to consider. And our study really isn't designed to look into the details. It would be nice, but we really don't have the cases. And I think you have to be cautious once you start going on a fishing expedition for interest, given our limited number of incident cases.
Sure. Okay, thank you. We have time for one final short question.
I'm Buvet from Antwerp. I was wondering whether you have incidence data on other STIs, and in particular genital ulcerations, did you see a difference? And in particular, genital herpes.
I think the question was about incident data with regard to other sexually transmitted infections. We do. We have a wealth of information about other sexually transmitted infections, which is currently being analyzed.
Thank you, Doug. So it's my pleasure to introduce the next paper. It's a modeling study presented by Cain Messison. Cain, 10 minutes.
I'll be presenting simulations today that show how various adult male circumcision programs could impact the HIV epidemic in Africa. In addition to maximizing the impact of current HIV prevention campaigns, additional effective HIV prevention technologies are needed. 25 years into the epidemic, 11,000 new HIV infections are still occurring globally every day. Although research into preventive tools, including vaccines and microbicides, as promising, large-scale implementation of these technologies is years away. Adult male circumcision is available now and is relatively affordable, safe, and acceptable. It is also highly effective. As we've heard, last year, the first randomized controlled trial for male circumcision conducted in South Africa was stopped after interim analysis showed that circumcision decreased female-to-male transmission of HIV by an astounding 61%. We are now awaiting the results for the other two large male circumcision trials underway in Uganda and Kenya. If these trials also show a significant reduction in HIV transmission, we will need to consider whether large-scale implementation of adult male circumcision programs should be added to our current arsenal of HIV prevention tools. We have three study questions. First, how do current rates of circumcision affect predicted trends in the HIV epidemic? We explore this effect over a 20-year horizon. Second, what impact would an expanded adult male circumcision program have on a developing country epidemic? We consider a 5-year program with varying coverage goals and look at the population benefits in terms of infections prevented and changes in HIV prevalence. Third, how might potential changes in risk behavior post-circumcision influence these outcomes? Specifically, we examine changes in condom use behaviors. We use the township of Soweto as an example to show the potential impact of expanded male circumcision programs in Africa. Soweto is located southwest of Johannesburg and close to the community of Orange Farm, where the first trial of male circumcision was recently conducted. We developed a mathematical model to examine what might happen if expanded adult male circumcision programs were implemented in Soweto. For those of you familiar with these methods, this is a dynamic transmission model linking male and female populations with differential equations governing movement between various states in the model. The basic idea is to use the model to simulate the course of the HIV epidemic using data and assumptions regarding population characteristics, HIV transmission and disease progression, circumcision, and sexual risk behavior. We assess the impact of various programs on heterosexual transmission of HIV, in particular varying circumcision efficacy and program coverage levels, as well as the potential for changes in sexual risk behavior following program implementation. Selected model inputs include an initial population of 823,000 sexually active adults, an HIV prevalence of 12% for males and 20% for females, disease progression times and infectivity values calculated from data out of rural Uganda. For circumcised males, a 61% decrease in the likelihood that HIV is transmitted when an infected male has sex with a when an uninfected male has sex with an infected female partner. A current circumcision rate of 35% for the male population, with expanded programs covering an additional percentage of uncircumcised adult males each year. A 50% baseline probability of condom use in all partnerships, which is male negotiated, and numbers of sexual partners per year varying from 0 to 3, depending on disease stage. This first graph will show the results of a 20-year simulation of predicted trends in Soweto adult HIV prevalence without considering the reduction in transmission due to current rates of male circumcision. The model predicts that female population HIV prevalence will increase from 20 to 21% and 127,000 new infections will occur over the next 20 years. Similarly, the male population HIV prevalence will increase from 12 to 25% and 191,000 new infections will occur over the same period. When we consider the reduction in HIV transmission due to current rates of male circumcision, the predicted trends in Soweto adult HIV prevalence change. The female population HIV prevalence now decreases to 17% and 102,000 new infections will occur over the next 20 years. Similarly, the male population HIV prevalence will only increase to 17% and 142,000 new infections will occur. So as we show here, the reduction in transmission due purely to current rates of male circumcision is significant even without an active effort to expand circumcision programs. Next, we consider the impact of a 5-year expanded male circumcision program targeting an additional 10% of the uncircumcised males each year, which is our base case scenario. We are now looking at figures for the entire adult population. On the horizontal axis is the 20-year time horizon, and on the vertical axis to the left is the total number of infections prevented in yellow. The simulation shows that over 20 years, this program could prevent 32,000 of the infections predicted for Soweto. On the vertical axis to the right is the prevalence of HIV in the population in blue. This first line shows the expected overall population prevalence if no program were implemented. This next line shows the prevalence with implementation of the program, which would reduce the 20-year prevalence of HIV from 17 to 14%. Therefore, even a modest expanded male circumcision program targeting an additional 10% of uncircumcised males would provide significant benefits. If instead we consider targeting an additional 20% of uncircumcised adult males each year in an expanded circumcision program, over 20 years, the program could prevent 53,000 infections in Soweto, and the prevalence of HIV in the population would be decreased even further to 13%. Thus, the benefits would be even greater for a program with a higher coverage goal. This is a table showing the number of infections prevented over 20 years for various 5-year expanded male circumcision programs. On the side are the two coverage levels, 10 and 20%, and along the top are various possibilities for circumcision protective effects. Given our best guess at present for the reduction in transmission due to male circumcision of approximately 60%, simulations predict 32 to 52,000 infections prevented as shown previously. However, regardless of the protective effect from circumcision pending from the other two trials for male circumcision in Kenya and Uganda, and here we show a range from 20 to 80%, modest circumcision programs will still provide significant benefits. We next consider the impact of a change in risk behavior following circumcision program implementation. If, for example, we implemented a program with a 20% coverage goal, but in this scenario, circumcised men decreased their condom use by 30%, over 20 years, with this increase in risk behavior, the program could only prevent 18,000 infections in Soweto, and the prevalence of HIV in the population would be decreased only to 15%. Thus, if risk behavior increased, the benefits of the program would be diminished. Because we are not yet sure whether the reduction in HIV transmission is truly 61%, nor do we know how much risk behavior might change, this graph allows us to look at all of the equivalent combinations of male circumcision protective effects on the horizontal axis and changes in condom use on the vertical axis that would prevent zero infections. This simulation, again, assumes a 5-year program with 20% coverage levels and looks at 20-year outcomes. In this instance, we are interested in seeing whether the program would have any effect in preventing infections. So this curve separates circumcision programs into those that would be harmful or helpful. All combinations of circumcision effect and risk behavior change below the curve would increase the number of infections, while all combinations above the curve would prevent infections. Any program resulting in increased condom use would be beneficial, and that's represented by the area above the horizontal axis. If the protective effect of circumcision is between 0 and 63%, or to the left of this arrow, and a program causes any decrease in post-circumcision condom use, then whether a program has a net benefit or harm depends on whether its parameters lie above or below the curve. But if the protective effect from circumcision is at least 63%, or to the right of this arrow, off the graph, then any 5-year circumcision program with 20% coverage levels will provide a net benefit over 20 years in terms of infections prevented, even if post-circumcision condom use decreases all the way to zero. Assuming that the protective effect of circumcision is actually 61%, then the program would be beneficial as long as post-circumcision condom use did not decrease by more than 94% from baseline levels or to less than 3%. In conclusion, the protective effects of male circumcision on HIV transmission significantly affect predicted outcomes and should be routinely included in HIV epidemic models. Circumcision is already having a tangible impact on the HIV epidemic and represents an important prevention technology available now. Even modest expanded male circumcision programs can confer substantial health benefits to males and females in South Africa and other populations with similar epidemic profiles, and these programs should be implemented immediately. Although these findings are sensitive to the impact of circumcision on subsequent risk behavior, all programs resulting in decreased risk behavior and even most programs resulting in increased risk behavior would still be beneficial. And programs to reduce risk behavior will remain an important component of successful prevention campaigns, including circumcision programs. Thanks.
Thanks, Kayin. Modeling paper has been published recently in PLOS Medicine. How will you compare the two studies, and are the outcomes of the two studies consistent?
Yes. The paper that was just published recently, the methodologies are somewhat different. We both use dynamic models, but the paper that was just published was looking at outcomes for sub-Saharan Africa, Africa as a whole. And this study actually looks at just a small community. So whereas this model is quite detailed and looks at a lot of subtle things that the big study doesn't look at, it can only make generalizations for a small community, whereas the PLOS paper can make very large generalizations about what this would do across Africa. So this study is really only sort of an example of what might happen in one town, as opposed to, you know, across Africa. But in general, the fact that circumcision will have substantial health benefits in terms of infections prevented and changes in HIV prevalence is still the same.
Thank you. First question is up front.
The question is, we don't really know what the behavioral disinhibition or risk compensation is. We don't know. A trial that's been completed was ended early, so we know nothing from that. And we don't know anything about the two trials, except when you cross, when you look across both conditions, it doesn't seem like there might be anything going on in the short term, but we don't know what the long term is. So here's my question. When you look at included the sort of sensitivity tests and the parameters that you included for behavioral disinhibition, did you include parameters for increased STDs? Because as condoms go down, we would expect other STDs to go up, which are, of course, driving many of the HIV infections in this part of the world. Are there parameters included for increased STDs in the model?
That's a really good question. We actually, in this model, have not included parameters for STDs. We model risk behavior as an increase or a decrease in condom use. We also have the ability to model it as an increase or a decrease in the number of partners, and I think that's an excellent point for further research.
Next question is back. Please keep your question short, please.
It's not on.
Maybe we should move to the front microphone while they're trying to figure out the back microphone. Front microphone question, please.
Kelly Curran.
Okay.
Kelly Curran from Topaigo, and I was curious why you didn't include in your model an estimated reduction of male-to-female transmission. My understanding is that the Rakai study team has estimated from data on discordant couples that there's an approximately 30% reduction in transmission from men to women.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I didn't have time to address that. What we've done for the present is only model a reduction in female-to-male transmission, only because that's the only study for which there's now been a randomized trial that has given results. I think Quinn and colleagues presented data at CROI this year showing that they're in the process of collecting that data so that we actually will have a real number to use in the future. But in the interim, I actually chose not to use any of the non-clinical trial data in this model. But that's definitely going to be an avenue for future research.
Can we have the question that was just been asked in the back, the man who wanted to ask the question, yeah. The blue short. Blue short, yeah. Can you, yeah, please. Yeah, go on. Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Next.
Thank you. David Stanton, USAID. Just a point of clarification in your model on condom use. First off, were you modeling correctly consistent condom use? Secondly, were you modeling actual reported levels of condom use today in Soweto, or was it a theoretical hypothetical level as baseline?
Okay, to answer your first question, we definitely do not model consistent condom use. We incorporate into the model a 14% effective condom failure rate over each partnership, so that's the first issue. We also incorporate, when we do risk behavior change, we incorporate changes in condom use post-circumcision. And your second question was, sorry, just remind me.
Was your baseline the actual reported level of condom use in Soweto, or is it a hypothetical level?
It's a hypothetical level backed up by several studies. I have the references on the talk, and I can give them to you afterwards. There are a number of national surveys coming out of South Africa, not from Soweto in particular, that do show, I think there's at least two major national surveys that do show that condom use is approximating 50% in this population. But it's also an assumption. It's
okay,
sort of a
question.
Rough assumption.
Next question is the back.
Not working.
Can you move quickly? Yeah, thank you. Sorry.
Okay, I got my exercise for today. So I would like to know what you think about the argument that male circumcision is a sexual mutilation. And also, if in your program of mass circumcision, if you think about having any program of support that will help men or boys that might be traumatized by those mutilation or circumcision.
Yeah. In this instance, I'm just trying to show what would happen if we rolled out a mass program. I think there's actually a lot of research that's going to have to go into making it acceptable, making it safe, making it wanted by the public, and not forcing it on anyone. I agree.
May I add that we are talking about adult male circumcision, and most of all the free trials are concerning people aged more than 18 years old, so they...
It's not because you're an adult that you might not be traumatized by the loss of your foreskin.
Hi, Olive Shisana from South Africa.
Hello.
Hi. Just two quick questions for you. I wondered whether you took into account the fact that the males who have, especially black males who have high HIV prevalence, are the older ones, older than 25 years of age. Whether you took that into account because they are the ones less likely to enter into circumcision if they are not circumcised right now. And then secondly, when I look at your graphs on incidence, the incidence of HIV among women in that particular age group of 15 to 24, hopefully the ones who are supposed to be sleeping with those men, it's actually high, about 4.5%, goes up to 3.7% by age, by age 24. And then for males of that same age, it's actually much, much lower, going, I think, as high as about 1.7.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When I see your incidence graphs, I'm a bit worried that they're actually showing the opposite of what we're seeing in terms of incidence in the country.
To answer your first question, in terms of an age-structured model, we have not separated this out by age groups, and that would be further research in making a more refined model. There is some work showing that you can sort of make very good approximations without adding an age structure into the model, so we haven't done that yet. And you are right that there are lots of reports in terms of older men having sex with younger women in South Africa. Actually, we have some research. I work in South Africa with the PHRU there, and there is some research to show that that is occurring, but in Soweto, in our population, it actually doesn't seem to be as high as one would think. In terms of the graphs, those actually aren't incidence graphs. Those are prevalence graphs. So it's the prevalence of the entire population, and it's the population of adults age 17 and older, so it's actually the entire adult population. But we do model the numbers you're talking about for the prevalence of young people. We model that as the incoming population, and we do use those numbers in terms of who's coming into the population.
Thank you. Tim, very short question.
Final
question, very short.
That is very kind. Tim, short answer. WHO. It's not so much a question but a plea from the modeling. I think this is extremely useful material. But I think there's one statistic which would be very valuable to come out here, is how we would see a reduction in prevalence translated into the prevalence of HIV in pregnant women. Because this is a statistic which is routinely used over many countries to monitor the HIV epidemic. And I think that would be very helpful to come out of all these models. I think it would certainly help the programming and the expectations that one could expect from increasing male circumcision programs.
Okay. Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Gain.
Good morning. I'm Jim Kahn, and I will be speaking on the... Sorry. She's going to tell you who I am.
Guess you don't want to hear from me. Go ahead. Our next speaker is Jim Kahn from UCSF. And he is going to present a cost-effective analysis that is derived from the Orange Farm data that has been published. And I just also want to add thank you very much to the audience for your rich amount of questions. I wish we had time to cover them all. Perhaps we can ask the speakers to stay extra time, and you can individually ask them questions as well. So go ahead, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you. I will be talking about the cost-effectiveness of male circumcision in reducing the spread of HIV in the general population in sub-Saharan Africa. By way of background, as we know, an important RCT conducted in Orange Farm showed a protective effect for adult male circumcision of 60% in reducing transmission from women to men, consistent with observational studies. And in the context of still limited resources for HIV prevention, we feel it's important to look at the economics of a biological intervention of this type. Thus, our goals were to assess the cost-effectiveness of male circumcision for Gauteng Province, South Africa, where the trial occurred, and then also to use the analysis to estimate the cost-effectiveness in sub-Saharan African settings with different epidemiology or costs. We looked at two major types of outcomes. We estimated HIV infections averted, and then we estimated the cost per HIV infection averted, and we did that two ways. First, we did it unadjusted for averted lifetime cost of HIV. In other words, we looked at the program cost divided by the estimated infections averted, and then we repeated that, adjusting for the averted lifetime cost of HIV. That is, if you avert infections, those people don't need medical treatment. And then we estimated a new ratio or, as you will see, savings from the program. These are our inputs. To estimate the costs of the program, we look at the cost of each male circumcision, including an allowance for promotion. We also looked at the frequency and cost of side effects. To estimate the effectiveness, we examined the HIV prevalence and estimated the HIV incidence in the men being circumcised. We, of course, included the protective effect of male circumcision on female-to-male transmission and the reduction of that protective effect due to risk compensation. In other words, when people feel they're better protected, they may increase their risky behaviors. We also looked at the multiplier effects due to epidemic dynamics, for example, the indirect protection to women. And then finally, in order to get a full economic picture, we looked at the savings from the medical costs of HIV infections averted. We estimated the cost of male circumcision is $50 US based on data from the Orange Farm trial, relying on general practitioners in the community, plus we allowed $5 for community promotion for each male circumcision. Mild side effects occurred in the short and long term for a total of 5% in the Orange Farm trial, requiring one outpatient visit, which from other data we estimate at $13. Serious side effects occurred 0.4% of the time, requiring two hospital days or approximately $330 in medical costs. The HIV prevalence among men in Gauteng province, according to provincial surveillance data, is about 26%. If the epidemic is stable, that leads to an estimated incidence of 3.8 per 100 susceptibles per year. The protective effect, 60% from the Orange Farm trial. Risk compensation in the Orange Farm trial was about 18%. We increased that a little bit for our base case analysis to 25% risk compensation. We then adapted an existing simple dynamic model that allowed us to estimate the epidemic multiplier, that is, the number of infections averted in the entire population as compared with the number averted in the men who get the circumcision, and that is 1.5. We did not include any effect of male-to-female riskiness. The lifetime cost of HIV treatment from studies in South Africa we estimated at $8,000 US, which is midpoint between the cost without and with ART. We did a 20-year analysis. Here's what we found. As previously noted, the cost of male circumcision is approximately $55 per male circumcision. The cost of adverse events, taking into account their frequency and then the medical care costs associated with those events, is approximately $1, yielding a total cost per male circumcision of about $56 US. The HIV infections averted per male circumcision, again based on the protective effect, risk compensation, and an estimate of the epidemic multiplier, is approximately 0.43 infections averted per male circumcision. Many of those infections occur in the future, and when we bring all of those estimates to the present using discounting at 3% per year, we estimate 0.31 discounted HIV infections per male circumcision. Then dividing the cost per male circumcision by the discounted infections averted, we estimate $181 per HIV infection averted without adjusting for averted medical costs. When we adjust for those averted medical costs, we estimate a net savings of approximately $2,400 per male circumcision. We did a variety of sensitivity analyses. This slide shows the sensitivity of the cost per HIV infection averted to the unit cost and protective effect. The underlying value of 181 is our base case value. As you can see on the upper right, if I can get my little mouse to work here, if the protective effect is 40% and the cost is $100, or twice what we assumed, the cost per HIV infection prevented is $688. In the case of a lower cost of $30 and a higher protective effect, the lowest cost per infection prevented is $93. All of the numbers in this table yield net savings when you adjust for averted medical costs. We also looked at alternate epidemic scenarios to be able to project the findings to other locations. In a lower steady state situation, that is with HIV prevalence of 8.4% instead of 26% and incidence at 1 per 100 susceptibles per year. The cost for HIV infection averted is estimated at $550, still yielding a net savings of $753 per male circumcision. If the epidemic is declining, for example, the prevalence is 26%, but risk behaviors have decreased for other reasons, the cost per HIV infection averted is $1,200, again, still with net savings of $264 per male circumcision. If there's a focus on young men with a lower prevalence but high incidence and growing prevalence, the cost per HIV infection is actually slightly lower than the base case. We looked at some program scenarios as well. We estimated at baseline $5 per male circumcision for recruitment and community promotion. If, in fact, you incur that kind of cost for eligibles, but only 1 in 10 get the male circumcision, that leads to a cost of $100 per male circumcision and net savings still of $253 per male circumcision. To reach a net cost of $0, that is, no cost and no savings, break even, the cost per male circumcision would have to rise 45-fold to nearly $2,500. Or the protective effect would have to drop 2/3 from the best estimate to 21% while the risk compensation remained the same. Scale has almost no effect on the cost per HIV infection prevented. If we place these results in the context of what is known about the cost-effectiveness of HIV prevention, we see that adult male circumcision at $181 per infection prevented is in the middle of the cost-effectiveness estimates. It's less expensive than voluntary counseling and testing, for example, and more expensive per infection prevented than peer education for sex workers. In conclusion, we find that adult male circumcision in sub-Saharan Africa appears to save money for a wide range of epidemic and economic conditions. We also want to emphasize that these data are from, we use the best available current data, which are largely from the Orange Farm clinical trial and other existing sources. As male circumcision programs come into being and scale up, we believe there will be an important opportunity to study the economics as well as the effectiveness in the context of real operating programs. And with that, maybe an opportunity to look at how to optimize the efficiency of the implementation of this important intervention. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions. Please keep them short, keep the answers short, so we can try to accommodate as many questions as possible. Please, go ahead. We're going to take them all from the front mic because the back one doesn't seem to work.
We have heard three or four presentations that start with an assumption of 60% effectiveness of circumcision derived from the Bertrand Over study in South Africa. I wonder whether that is appropriate, because actually this was an intention to treat analysis, but if you assume circumcision really happened, you should take the as-treated analysis of effectiveness, which is slightly higher. I wonder whether Petr Over would want to comment on that.
Jim?
I think it's a very good question and comment. I don't have really have things to say except that I'm surprised that all these papers based on the value of 60% are giving very positive outcomes. So I'm glad that if you assume a higher efficacy, of course the outcome will be even better. So for me, 60 is the value that we have to take into account. Maybe it will change with the two other trials, but for the moment, I think I'd rather stay to this value.
Okay, next question. In front.
Hi, Nina Kammerer from Brandeis University. I'm wondering if any of the modeling, and especially sort of public health planning, assuming that the other two trials come back with similar results, what kind of modeling is being done on the savings in terms of lives, not costs, for childhood circumcision and what kind of public health planning we might already be doing in terms of having that part of postnatal care?
That's an excellent question, and obviously the doing childhood circumcision is an important public health opportunity. We did not examine that specifically in this analysis, but we talked about considering that as well. Any next?
Hi, I just wanted to know, does the analysis take into account training costs and initial scale-up, especially in the beginning? I think safety is going to be a big concern if this is implemented.
The training costs in the Orange Farm trial were very, very low and it involved a short one-time training session and were not large enough to affect the cost of delivering the male circumcision.
So. However, though, if this is scaled up and actually implemented as a policy, there will be a lot of training costs to really scale this up effectively and safely.
Yeah, I think one of the trade-offs as we scale up programs will be if you rely on clinicians who have less prior training but are less expensive and you need to do more training around the male circumcision, how will that trade-off be about their lower baseline earning rate versus the need for extra training? That would be an important thing to look at. Thank you.
Inon Schenker from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. We're documenting now the massive male adult circumcision, voluntary, mostly of Eastern European immigrants to Israel. We are talking about thousands. And I wondered if you could allude to the point of taking into account that a traditional healer, a mohel, would perform male circumcision in about 7 minutes, including the blessings and the prayers, to a child 8 days old. What would be the most important variable you would put into a cost-effective estimation, taking into account actually that procedure not being on adults, but actually at birth? Thank you.
Thank you. I think you're allowing me to bring together part of my personal life with my kids and my professional work. I think it makes sense to look at who are the appropriate providers of male circumcision in different settings. Obviously, the potential for that strategy in Israel is different from the potential for that strategy in South Africa. And I think you have to look at who is providing acceptable and safe male circumcisions in the context in which you're working.
Sten Vermon, Vanderbilt. Jim, your comment, the scale-up, did not actually affect your cost model much, came as a little bit of a surprise. I was wondering why one would not achieve some level of herd immunity, some level of increasing benefit with larger coverage, very analogous to a vaccine. And why didn't you see that in your model?
Thank you. Good question. I should have expanded on that more. I want to first clarify that when I'm talking about scale-up effects, it has to do with the epidemiologic effects, as your question addressed, not the economic efficiencies of scale-up. Regarding the epidemiologic effects, we found that there were countervailing forces. There were, in fact, somewhat more herd effects, but also then in a sense, the earlier circumcisions are acting on a community at higher risk. The later circumcisions are acting on a community at a lower risk because of the earlier circumcisions, and they tend to balance out. I'd be happy to get into the technical nitty-gritty if you want. It was the interesting part of it.
Marge Baer, Reproductive Health Matters. A couple of questions. Are you taking into account...
One question, please. You have four people behind you. Sorry.
I'm happy to answer other questions afterwards. But please.
Well, then the one question is, given that this is the only session on male circumcision in the entire conference, is there going to be somewhere where we can have a proper debate and discussion of these issues, apart from a few questions?
Yes.
I turn that to the moderators.
Daniel Halperin, USAID. I'm glad there's at least one session. There wasn't one session at the last AIDS conference. Most of what I wanted to say briefly was already mentioned. I think the modeling is very interesting, and I think it's great that it's fairly conservative modeling. But as Bertrand pointed out, even with that conservative assumptions, you're finding these findings. The per protocol analysis in the Ornstrom trial, and this is in the published papers, was 76%. And we're doing work in Swaziland where we estimate the cost per circumcision could come down to about $25. Also, the Rakai trial funded by Gates Foundation may find some reduction male to female, direct reduction. So it is possible, at least hypothetically, that if you add in the male to female reduction, the lower cost, and the higher possible female to male reduction, you could even find more dramatic cost findings and so on, couldn't you?
Absolutely right.
Dr. Hankins, quick question, please.
Dr. Hankins, UNH, just a question. The Orange Farm trial showed no significant differences in condom use between the two arms or in the numbers of partners. There was an increase in frequency of sex. How did you get, first of all, the 18% that you used to bump up to 25% for risk compensation? Where does that come from?
I believe that was the frequency of contacts. It may not have been significant, but we nonetheless took it as a point estimate.
So you compiled the
That was the increase of frequency of sexual contact that we observed during the first 9 months. We observed 18%. So okay. we have taken this value.
Okay, good. Thanks.
And okay.
Well, I had a number of questions, but we're asked to ask only one, and I don't know which one to ask precisely. But maybe of more importance for me is to know, is this debate true for circumcision for in adult male, or it's also true for people who've been circumcised when they're still young?
Well, from the point of view of our analysis, we looked at circumcision in adult males. Looking at it in children might affect the costs of doing the procedure, and it would also affect this discounting that I mentioned, and the benefits would be further in the future. I suspect the results would look pretty similar, but we haven't done it.
Okay, one more question. I'm sorry. Then we're going to have to cut it off. I apologize.
Judy Wasserite, University of Washington. Very nice, Jim. Thank you.
Judy.
My question has to do with whether in the next iteration of your modeling you would consider folding in epidemic phase in terms of the multiplier effect, because one might expect that in earlier phase or more concentrated epidemics where you have higher rates of curable STDs, there would be a greater impact through that pathway than in generalized epidemics.
That's an interesting point. The epidemic multiplier had to do with two things. One was change over time, which is what you're alluding to in the epidemic course, and the other has to do with passive protection to women. But I like the suggestion. Maybe we can chat about it.
My question, or rather suggestion, is to all the panelists. And I'd like to find out if male circumcision in Africa, if you're going to consider to actually engage the traditional healers, because in most of the African traditions, these healers have been, I mean, we've had traditional healers that have been conducting circumcision for centuries, for a very long time, and instead of having maybe a whole new group of people to train and if you would consider engaging people that have been doing this for a long time.
I would ask if Bob or Patron wants to comment.
Bob.
Quickly.
Very quickly. I think it's an excellent idea, and many people have discussed it. The problem is the little data that we have from traditional circumcisers shows that actually their rates of adverse events are extremely high. And so they would require at least as much training as any clinical officers or medical officers. So there could be real advantages since they're close to the community, but there may not be advantages in terms of cost of training and rollout.
Okay, I'm sorry, we cannot take any more questions. I'm sorry, I'll have to do it afterwards. We need to give our next speaker an opportunity to talk within the time frame. The next speaker I have the pleasure of introducing is Dr. Kawango Goat from the UNIM Project. It is her site in Kisumu that is performing the circumcisions in yet one of the other randomized clinical trials that is ongoing. And she's going to give us perspective from what they are seeing at that site present.
Thank you. The presentation is on male circumcision, a prospective study to assess behavioral disinhibition among the Luo of Western Kenya. And it's not related to the study that Dr. Bailey mentioned or talked about. The study is supported by Fogarty International Center, and which is backwards. And the USAID through the Population Council and AIDS Mark. So in terms of background, I won't go into any of these because you've had that. Just to mention that circumcision has shown some help or some protective effect on women. And as we know that if it's not helpful to women, it's not helpful at all. So if the two randomized controlled trials that are ongoing confirm the results of South Africa, then demand for circumcision may increase. And 13 studies on acceptability have been conducted in 9 African countries, with 45 to 80% of circumcised men reporting that they would accept circumcision were it to be provided, as long as the issues around cost and fear of pain and all the other adverse events were addressed. But the main reasons that they cited for wanting for accepting circumcision included improvement in genital hygiene, enhancement of sexual pleasure both to self and to partner, and reduction of risk for STIs, for HIV, and for penile cancer. So if male circumcision were to become popular, then men may get circumcised in the false belief that they are protected and therefore may subsequently adopt more risky sexual behaviors. And we conducted a study to assess this in among men who elected to be circumcised. It wasn't a randomized controlled trial. The study was based in two public healthcare settings, where circumcisions routinely occur, and our argument was that clinical trial settings are usually highly controlled with really screening out all unhealthy people, those who don't meet eligibility requirements, and really high-level training and high-level monitoring and so on. And therefore, we wanted to look at the other side of a typical healthcare setting where circumcisions would routinely occur and to find out whether what kind of response we shall get in terms of behavioral disinhibition. So, as I said, this was a prospective cohort study with 12-month follow-up at months 1, 3, 6, 12, 6, 9, and 12. We enrolled 648 circumcised men, and half of them offered circumcision. Preferred to be circumcised, and half of them remained uncircumcised. And the men were matched with regards to age, within 2 years in terms of age, marital status, and residence. Participants chose the group to which they belonged. As I mentioned, it wasn't a true randomization process. And at every follow-up visit, medical exam was performed, medical history was taken, and behavioral questionnaire administered. And we had additional visits by the circumcision group at 3 and 8 days post-procedure. It was kind of modeled pretty close to the Kisumu trial, which I coordinate. The outcome measures were reported sexual behaviors known to place men at risk of acquiring HIV, and one was married men reporting sex with partners other than their spouses, and unmarried men reporting sex with partners other than those that they defined as regular girlfriends. And we looked at this, we divided this into two, those who just reported risky sex per week, rather than not in a week, per week, as more than zero and below 0.5 per week and over 0.5 per week, and those who reported risky and unprotected. So one is just having sex with somebody that's not a spouse and not a regular girlfriend, and another is having sex, unprotected sex, with a non spouse and non regular partner. We also looked at condom use, ever consistent, and also number of risky sexual partners per month. So in terms of results, the baseline characteristics show that there was no difference between circumcised, those who elected to be circumcised and those who remained uncircumcised with regard to age, marital status, income, education, condom use, STIs, and average number of risky sexual partners at the bottom. It was interesting that the study, the eligibility was 18 to 49 years old, and what we see is that those who opted to join the study were only between 20, well, about between 18 and 27, 28. So a lot of young men came, older guys did come. But we found a difference in those who reported deviation during erection, difficulty achieving erection, risky sex acts in the previous 3 months, and unprotected sex acts in the previous 3 months, and also those who reported difficult insertion during intercourse, and we adjusted for these in our analysis. So in comparison, for those who reported risky sexual behavior, this is not unprotected, this is overall risky sexual behavior. At 1 month, there was a difference for those who had over 0.5 sex acts per week. Were higher, significantly higher among those who were circumcised, which of course is obvious. The circumcised guys are still healing, plus we gave post-op instructions, both verbal and written, and therefore we believe that they took those seriously. And then we see that for the rest of the month, there is actually no significant difference between circumcised and uncircumcised group, and also overall, the 12-month overall. Now we see more or less the same trend with unprotected sexual behavior, those who reported not using condoms, consistent condom use. And but those who reported more than 0.5 sex acts per week, there was no difference across from month one all the way to the end. But what we did realize is those who reported more than zero but below 0.5 sex acts per week, there was a significant difference. In terms of those who reported condom use and number of risky sexual partners, we also see in terms of risky sexual partners, those who reported more than one risky sexual partners per month were significantly higher in uncircumcised men, of course, obviously, given that the other guys were healing, but we didn't see any difference from month one all the way to month 12 in terms of those who reported risky sexual health. But the thing that is a little worrying is the fact that about 14% of the men had sex among those who were circumcised had sex before 1 month despite counseling. So in terms of summary of results at month 12 follow-up, 86% of the participants remained in follow-up, 89% in circumcised men and 83% uncircumcised men. And men more likely to be lost to follow-up were single, had lower income, and had completed high school. Obviously, these are men who were jobless and therefore migrated out to look for job opportunities. And of circumcised men, 47% cited protection from STI as their reason for choosing to be circumcised. And others were improvement in genital hygiene and to avoid injuries during sex. 1 month following circumcision, men were 61% less likely to report over 0.5% sex acts per week, and 63% less likely to report over one but equal to or less than 0.5 sex acts per week. The same trend is observed in terms of protected risky sex, except that at month one, for those who reported more than 0.5 sex acts per week, there was no significant difference between the two. And for the remaining 11 months, we didn't observe any difference. So, clients, I would say first, in terms of discussion, we had a number of limitations. One is that the clients were not randomized to circumcision or control, and that we did not test for HIV, and hence we were unable to assess the effect of HIV status on behavior. But we were arguing that if circumcision was to be rolled out, then there won't be need for these rigorous clinical trial requirements. The duration of follow-up was also rather short. That was 12 months. Initially, it was actually 6 months, and only with the support of USAID did we extend to another 6 months. But we are doing this. We are following up plans in the UNIM trial up to 66, 67 months, so we are hoping that we'll get additional information in this area. That the frequent visits and associated counseling could have had a dampening effect on risk behavior and made the two groups be closer. And, of course, we had a little concern about self-report. And except for erectile dysfunction problems and STIs in the last 3 months, the rest of the background behavior was no different. Sexual behaviors associated with increased risk for HIV acquisition did not differ between the two groups. And even though 47% chose circumcision to protect themselves against STI or HIV, their behavior after circumcision did not differ from those who chose circumcision for other reasons. And our results suggest that within the context of adequate counseling on risk reduction, any benefits of circumcision is not likely to be adversely affected by this, adversely affected in this population, and we call for similar studies in other settings. And just appreciation for the funding from the Fogarty International Center, NIH, and University of Washington's IRTP, and Population Council, USAID, and the study team, and the brave participants who agreed to be circumcised.
Okay. I have questions, and it appears the back microphone may not be working, so I don't know if you want to come to the front one, but go ahead. Identify yourself. One question each, quickly, please.
My name is Gary Dowsett from La Trobe University in Australia. I wanted to register growing concern among the social scientists at this meeting about discussions of circumcision being decontextualized from cultural and political consequences. This panel has not included anybody who is analyzing circumcision as a cultural act. Anthropologists can tell you a lot more about circumcision that it is not a prevention technology. This is a deeply meaningful social and cultural act, as our Jewish and Muslim friends can tell us, and any anthropologists can tell us. To decontextualize this act from its context is one of the lessons we learned that we should not do in this epidemic from the start. And even if some kind of effectiveness is demonstrated, there are many public health tools we don't use in this epidemic because of their moral and ethical consequences, such as quarantine. We know that quarantine can work in infectious diseases, but we don't use it, and we opposed it because of the moral, ethical, and political consequences for people with HIV. So why these kinds of questions are not being addressed on a joint panel of social scientists, community people, and the kind of science you people do, completely fetishizes this act and makes it impossible to have a really considered debate about its public health consequences.
I think we can move to the back microphone because I believe it works.
Thank you. Yes, it does work. I'm Robert Klitzman from Columbia University in New York. For the last speaker here, I was very struck that there was a significant difference between those who elected for circumcision, those who didn't, based on deviation of, I guess, penile deviation and also difficulty achieving erection. In other words, that men who had those problems were opting for circumcision. And I'm wondering if that's suggestive of a misunderstanding of why they would undergo circumcision or why circumcision, what the benefits to them might be.
Okay, I would just say in the first one that as one of us had called for a more intensive debate, I leave that to the moderators that, you know, people need to debate this issue more openly and with more time. In terms of erectile dysfunction, we recognize that there's a lot of news on the press, a lot of talks going on around, and a lot of hope, I would think, because from the little bit I hear that erectile dysfunction is one of the greatest fears of men, and they would look for any solution, anything that may help, and I think they must have come with a feeling that perhaps circumcision may offer some kind of way out of what their problems are. And it does show us that probably if circumcision were to be rolled out, this could be the group that may rush for circumcision, but maybe for the wrong reasons. That's my guess.
But I'm wondering then what that suggests about implementing this more broadly, if people are going to be going into it with a misunderstanding of what the benefits may be, whether down the road there might be consequences of that misunderstanding.
I think it does call for really proper, consistent education on what is the extent. We don't want to popularize it as the panacea of all the issues, but we have to really build it to our education, information about what circumcision can do, up to what level and what it can't do, so that people don't go into it thinking that he is going to solve all your problems and that is you're going to be protected from HIV in the first place.
Thank you.
Front microphone, please.
Yes, I'm Jake Peters from the Canadian AIDS Treatment Information Exchange. At the beginning of the opening, during the opening ceremonies, Melinda Gates made a statement that circumcision reduces the incidence of HIV and AIDS. And Dr. Ako, you alluded to the question I'm going to ask, which is that many people may feel that circumcision may be the solution to the problem. But I think by making these kinds of statements,
stand a little closer to the microphone.
Making these statements. Generally, I think can contribute to a problem where people really do they will wonder what is the point of using it. It confuses the issue about use of condom compared to circumcision, and the kind of language and messages that come out that are contributing to the rise of new infection rates are similar to the language that's used in the medications being described as, for example, cocktails. When you have naive youth coming out feeling that HIV is not a problem because all they need is a cocktail. It's a very simple solution to a very serious problem. It's a misrepresentation of the truth. And if you're looking at people who are in sub-Saharan Africa who are don't have access to education or what we take for granted in this society, they're going to be confused by hearing statements saying that circumcision, like they're just going to wonder there's a conflict here. You say that on the one hand that HIV is prevented by circumcision to some extent, and yet they will feel then what's the need to, why would they need to use condoms? Do you understand what I'm saying? There's confusion on people.
Yeah, but what I can say is that, as has been mentioned by the previous speakers, that when we're talking about circumcision, we're not talking about it as a standalone prevention strategy. We are saying that if the studies conclude that it's beneficial, it has to be incorporated into the whole spectrum of comprehensive prevention strategies, including condom use and abstinence and faithfulness and other risk reduction, needle exchange and everything else.
Yeah, but
You understand what I mean about the confusion. When the message comes out, when a statement is made and it's spread out in the media, as it was during the opening ceremonies, that, as Melinda Gates stated it, people take that and they can become confused because they walk away with that message and they're genuinely confused.
I think your point is understood.
Yeah, but I think it does call on us, on those who are working at the local level, to then make sure that our education messages are like homegrown, so that they address those issues at the local level. Because as we are educating people, there are so many messages that are going to go up, and you can't stop people from listening to what the other people are saying. But it will be upon us that are operating at the local level to make sure that we make our messages be very clear in terms of what circumcision can do and what it cannot do.
Okay, back microphone, please.
Okay, thank you. My name is Njabulo Mabaso. I'm from South Africa. I would have loved to hear from the studies presented, explaining some of the mysteries associated with the role of the foreskin scientific, because as far as, I will agree with you that circumcision is quite beneficial, but I don't think that there was no role for it at all. Number one, to say we quite know that Langerhans cells present in the foreskins are quite more susceptible to infection by HIV. But whereas in the same breath, there is also lysozyme produced by the foreskin, which kills HIV. And these studies have not explained those mysteries what benefit of the protective effects of the foreskin. I would have loved that to come out of your studies. And lastly, the question of the method of conducting the circumcision itself with the guillotine method versus the dissecting method, which has not also come out of your studies as to which method was used and which one you preferred. Because as some speaker mentioned here earlier on that, you know, there are circumcisions performed by African traditional healers, of which mostly of those, as an African I know, they are more of a guillotine, you know, kind of a procedure followed, as opposed to the dissection method. Thank you.
Bertrand? Okay, we're going to allow 5 more minutes or less than questions, so they need to be a single question and very, very, very short. Dr. Weaver.
Maria Waver, Johns Hopkins University and Rakai Health Sciences Program. We are conducting the third randomized trial of HIV prevention in negative men, but we're also, with Gates' support, conducting a complementary study that looks at HIV-positive men, safety and STD effects, and looking at safety, STD, and HIV effects in women. So that will be very complementary. We're also looking at community aspects, community understandings of HIV acceptability among positive, negative women and men who don't want to be circumcised. So it will be, this ties into the comments that were made by Kamongo, very nice talk by the previous speaker about the need also to look at women, because in our observational data we see substantial reductions, up to 50% lower incidence among female partners of HIV positive men who are circumcised in our observational data, and we strongly believe that that needed to be tested in randomized trials. So this isn't a question, it's just a little addition.
Thank you. There are also some posters on male circumcision today. If the audience is interested, they can see some of those too. Back microphone.
Okay. Caroline Allen, Medical Research Council. I'm a social scientist, so I'm interested in what the previous person said about circumcision. My question is, did you research what the reasons were for choosing circumcision among cohort? I think it's really important to understand norms surrounding male circumcision around genital hygiene and also about female genital hygiene and how partners negotiate about these kind of things, and also how possible results such as those from Orange Farm might influence in the future take-up of male circumcision. I think we need a lot more research about these issues. So my question is, were the people asked prior to your study?
Yeah, we did, as I mentioned, we did ask them the reason why they were opting for circumcision, since this was elective circumcision, and there was a report of enhancement of sexual pleasure, there was the report of genital hygiene, there was the report of reduction in STI and HIV as their reason for choosing that. What we didn't do was to do a more, ethnographic follow-up or study on the issues around hygiene and so on and so forth. But that's being done by one of our core studies in UNIP, the one that was presented initially. So that's going on, and we're hoping to get more rich data in terms of that.
Front microphone, please.
My name is Nisha Hanif. I'm from Jamaica AIDS Support. Dr. Agud, I'm very happy to see your face on the panel. One of my concerns about the entire conference is the whole structure of panels being primarily from the West, from people who are predominantly white, talking to us about our bodies. And my question is this: how can we roll out projects like these that tell us to tell men, particularly black men, what to do with their penises from research that's from a predominantly white and Western structure? It's impossible. I work on the front lines of HIV/AIDS, and we cannot get men to use a condom. In my work in women's reproductive health, trying to get them to get to cut their what's the name of that thing? with doing vasectomies. Impossible. We're going to tell them now to have a vasectomy, a circumcision. What you're asking us to do and to think about must involve scientists from our cultures at the very start as leaders of the science, not as followers. Thank you.
In the back, please.
Thank you very much indeed. I was very, very interested in listening to the speakers. I'm Elizabeth Gogi from Kenya, Nairobi. And what I would really like to say is that, to suggest is that we need to do research, find out the perception of women, find out the perception of the elders, find out the perception of circumcisers from the traditional healers who do this anyway. Let's not ignore them. But also there are rituals that the people follow when they are circumcising the young men. What are these issues? Can we borrow scientifically and anthropologically some commemorate some of this to design acceptable methods of rolling out this program? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe just to say one thing is, Elizabeth, that's going on. Like, my boss did a study in Bungoma that's actually looking at the traditional providers of circumcision. And many of the circumcision studies the acceptability studies also asked the women, and a number of the women actually also preferred to have circumcised, not as many, but to prefer to have circumcised spouses or partners, and also agreed to circumcise their children. Of course, the percentage was much lower, but these have been asked in the acceptability studies, and we have records for that. And of course, there's also in Kenya, we have Dr. Judy Brown, that's also doing a lot of trying to incorporate teachings on HIV prevention during the cultural circumcision ceremonies. So that it's not just the normal cultural ceremonies about growing up, but that gets infused with the teachings on HIV reduction that's going on at the camps, which really is a neat thing going on.
I'm sorry, I've gotten a note from the organizers that we have to stop now. We've gone 15 minutes over, and we're going to disrupt the next session, so I'm terribly sorry. We cannot take any more questions.